Session number 21735, Reel 6.
Bob Shrimpton, Reel 6. During this time, Bob, while you were doing your basic training, did you have to do any guard duties at all?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. That's all part of it, to share it all around. We had to do shifts on guard work down at the main gate or around the perimeter fences because there was always this feeling that perhaps somebody may try to break in or break out, as the case may be. So you still had to do your guard duties. But invariably, what happened was that one of us would probably be selected from a hut, guard duty on the gate. But you always did guard duty with an experienced sailor or a Royal Marine who were seconded to the barracks. So you were never there left on your own. I mean, you were always with a senior, trained, long-serving member of the Navy. So you weren't left on your own.
Were you armed at all?
Yes, you carried rifles, bayonets, and I think we were allowed 5 rounds of live ammunition. But if you fired one off and you couldn't justify the firing that off, you were in dead trouble. You were really in dead trouble. The other thing, of course, down there was air raids. They tried several times to, as you know, to cripple Portsmouth Harbour. And I remember at night sometimes, especially being on the guard duty on the gate, these tractors or lorries would come along trailing a large tank-looking unit, a square tank on wheels, and they were oil burners, and they used to light up this fuel oil, and these jets of black smoke would go up into the air, and the idea was to cover the whole of the area with a blanket of black smoke. It was terrible. I mean, if you had a clean white shirt on when you went on guard duty, believe me or not, with all the smuts that came in afterwards, it was dead dirty afterwards. And I know the local people used to suffer as well because they had to shut their windows up. But there again, it was a crude way of trying to blot out any sort of landmarks that air raids could use, air bombers could use. But it was vile, these smoke tanks, terrible. But, yeah, that was basically the guard duties, actually.
Did any incidents occur while you were on guard?
No, not really. One or two lads tried to creep in under the wire, and that's all. We didn't mind people coming back in, as long as they didn't try to get out. And we knew roughly where they were, and we'd probably say, well, look, I'm not going to be there when you want to come back in. but we were fairly strict. We kept a watchful eye on things. Basically, it was the security of the barracks. You know, there was nothing there for anybody they could probably blow up a few huts or something like that, but there was nothing of any strategic nature that anybody would want to attack the camp for.
And did you have, at that period in the basic training, any sporting activities?
Oh, yeah. Oh, good Lord, yeah. I mean, there was always a football match and that sort of thing. Because I wasn't there during the cricket season, as I said, but it was, yeah, I mean, football, boxing, and all this sort of thing. Yeah, there was plenty of that went on.
Did you play football?
Oh, I played football. Yeah, I played football, and I boxed as well. Yeah, because my father was a semi-professional footballer. And so it was instinctively in our blood to play football. Mind you, I remember now that when you come to think of the modern football, compared with the ones that we had, which were heavy leather and very, very well worn, as you can imagine. And if we played in the wet, it was like heading a sack of coal. Everybody volunteered for sports of some sort.
Who would you play football against?
Any other hut. Any hut would say, OK, we've got a team, a better game of football. No shortage of volunteers. In fact, you only played probably half the team, then you'd all swap over and somebody else would play. But, it was great.
When would you play?
Where?
When?
Usually, late afternoons when all your training had been finished, or on Sundays, which was more or less a day off. You went to church, prayed in the morning, but your afternoons were making amends afternoons, and that's when a lot of the sports were taking part. Boxing was normally done in the evening in the gymnasium, that was always good fun too. Everybody used to turn out for that. Not many of them boxed, but everybody turned out to watch it. It was good fun.
Did you fight at different weights?
Oh yes. I mean, there's no good going in as a bantamweight fighting a heavyweight, but the PTIs were pretty good on that. They would assess you as to your skills and your size and your heights, and so you never came up against real brutal opposition. So it was very well organised. Very good PTIs they were. Very good.
What weight did you fight at?
Lightweight. Yeah, lightweight. And I think, if I remember, it was only a few years ago, I was the same weight then as I was when I joined the Navy. I hadn't altered weight at all. That's one thing that never fluctuates with me, weight. It's incredible.
So how many bouts would you have had?
Well, it was only three rounds per match. But I fought quite a number of bouts, and I did later on in life. I fought in China, I remember, against the American 7th Fleet. So I had quite a few in my time, because I was in a boxing club before I joined the Navy, while I was still at school in Fleet. And I had an army, ex-army PTI, and he formed a boxing club. And, my father loved boxing too. He knocked me about a bit.
Did you win many of those?
I won quite a few. Oh, yes, I won quite a few. I had one or two nasty cuts over the eyes and that sort of thing, but no, I used to go in there for great fun. It was great fun. There was no animosity then. There was no hype or bitterness or something like that, you know. I mean, if we had a scrap of a Sunday evening in the gymnasium and we got permission to go ashore, we'd go and, you know, have a drink together. I mean, that's what boxing is about. It's a true sport.
Would the petty officer instructors, if there was a problem between two recruits, would they occasionally ask that to be settled in the boxing ring? Would that happen?
Oh, yes, that's been done. Yeah, it depends on the nature of the argument. If it was a physical argument, you say, you can stop that fighting now, up in the gym, put the gloves on. I mean, but if it was a psychological argument, you know, that sort of thing, that would be altered. That wouldn't be done in the boxing ring. But only if it was a physical type of argument. That's when they say, get your gloves on, you know, that sort of thing.
Did you do any other sports? You mentioned football and boxing and basic training. Anything else?
Not a lot, no. I like physical exercise. But we didn't do much. And we did one or two bits of cross-country running, but you've got to realise there wasn't all that amount of time in your intensive training to do too much. I think, quite honestly, the physical exercise of running between one training session and the other was quite sufficient to keep you reasonably fit.
You mentioned all this about how your days were structured and the things you were involved in. How would you know what you were doing in your day? How would you be notified of that?
It was usually pinned up in your hut, what sessions you were going to do. And you knew very well that at 8 o'clock you had to be in that hut, 10 o'clock you had to be there, and then you were followed by that. So it was all structured. Because this had to be done, you see, because you imagine you've got probably 1,000 men there, they all had to be fitted in different classrooms, and so they had to find, if that classroom was empty, number 10 hut would go in there, number 2 hut would go over there. So it was all structured, and that was pinned up in your hut every day, so you knew exactly where you'd be every hour of that day.
Is there anything else you remember of your...
Well, not at Collingwood, because I was only there 8 weeks. Then, of course, then you had your assessment time. Oh, yeah, there's one thing I remember very vividly. Just before we had to finish our training, we had to go for our inoculations and injections, and this was done in RMB Portsmouth. So we were transferred there by coach. And, or truck rather. And we were lined up in this corridor, tops off, arms akimbo, like this. And you had to, as the man in front of you stepped forward, you step up. As you passed this doorway, there was this arm came out with this damn great syringe. And you stabbed this syringe in your arm and give you an injection, and your arm, you felt as if it dropped off. And then you walked out the end, put your tops on, and they say, right, double. And you double marched a party of 10 down the quay into a whaler. And then you had to row round Portsmouth Harbour for about half an hour. They said it was to get the circulation going in your arm. Well, I don't know about circulation, but when we got back, you sort of walked along as if you only had one arm. It was agonising. And it took about a day for it to wear off. That was modern medical attention, that was. God, you never forget that bit.
So how did you hear where you were drafted to from?
Well, then, of course, you had your assessment. The day you came, where you had to pack your kit, and you went into the division officer's office, and he'd say, right, here's your assessment for your training. You passed here. You are now being transferred to ASDIC training. I'd been warned about this several days beforehand. So I was given a travel warrant, and then it was as quick as that. We were transferred. First, we had to go into a holding camp, it's just outside of Portsmouth. We were put up in bell tents. Remember that, with all duck boards all around it. We spent about one night there, that's all. And then we had a travel permit, and I said, well, where am I going? And they said, you're going up to Campbelltown. I said, where's Campbelltown? Said, in Scotland, in Argyllshire. Well, I'd never been much north of Reading before in my life. So I was just put on this train. I think there were two of us, that's all, went up there. And we travelled there. I think it took us 2 days to get there, up to Glasgow, from Glasgow by boat through Bute, down to Port Talbot, and then a rickety old charabang round to Campbelltown. And this was HMS Nimrod, land-based. I believe it used to be a former girls' school, which had been requisitioned by the Navy. The funny thing about it was, back in 1970, I took the wife up there for a motoring trip around Scotland. I said, we'll go to Campbelltown, find out where HMS Nimrod was. Well, I went round Campbelltown, and I couldn't find this blessed girls' school. Because remember, during a training up there, we left 4 o'clock in the morning on trawlers in the dark. We arrived back in Campbelltown at 10 o'clock at night in the dark. I never saw Campbelltown in daylight, only probably once briefly. I went up and down this street looking for this old girls' school. Couldn't find it. I said, I'm not going to be done. So I went into a local police station, and there was this police constable with a load of red medal ribbons up, wartime. I thought, he's the boy. I said, excuse me, I'm trying to find where I was based up here for HMS Nimrod. It used to be a girls' school. He started laughing, and he said, come with me, lad. And we went to the doorway, and he said, you see over there, all those houses? I said, yeah. He said, that's a new estate. The girls' school's underneath it. So I never, ever found it. But I vividly remember our washing facilities there. In this courtyard, there was a high granite wall on the cut into the side of the mountain. And through the holes came this mountain's water in trickles. And they had half-moon concrete basins underneath one of these. And this was the washing facilities for when the girls were there. So we had to trail out in the morning in the courtyard and wash in this mountain stream. Very invigorating, but it wasn't very pleasant in the winter time.
You mentioned that you've been selected for tactic training.
Yeah.
At the school. And you said that you'd gone up with one other person. With the recruits, when you were at Collingwood, how many would go on to ASDIC training? Was that considered quite a specialist thing?
Yeah, because you see, like HMS Belfast should have had a section of 8 ASDIC crew to cover all the watches. We only ever had 6. The shortage was so great.
And that was all on your aptitude, was it?
That's on your aptitude test, yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, you did mention that you were good at knots and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So I could have been, I could have landed up as a seaman. You know, it's just the way it goes. It's just your aptitude test. I mean, you could quite obviously... I mean, some people, you see, were very good at clerical work, so they became ship's writers and this sort of thing. So they, in that 8 weeks at Collingwood, they had to assess you as to your adaptability for various sections of the Navy, whether you're going to be an artificer, a torpedoman, a gunner. So it was a very, very intense work. And I think the officers and the petty officers there, the old boys there, they did a marvellous job trying to fit everybody into their right sections.
And what time of year had you arrived at Nimrod?
I think... trying to think now. It must have been about August, September time, I suppose. Around about that sort
42.
Of time. Yeah.
So you mentioned the ablutions in Nimrod. What was the rest of the accommodation like?
Well, it was a very, very old granite-built place. Very imposing. It was all fitted out with metal cots and that sort of thing, because all the girls had been transferred elsewhere. And so it was all very, very basic. They had a kitchen down there with a couple of naval cooks in there. And I think there was only about 20 of us altogether on submarine detection training. But we didn't spend much time. We did a few lectures in the school, with charts and diagrams and this sort of thing, and certain amount of training equipment. But our main training was done on trawlers. We would go aboard these seagoing trawlers, and you'd be out all day, and they'd have a training submarine out there, and you had to find it. There was one beautiful boat I went on. It was called the Shamara, and it originally belonged to Lord and Lady Docker, who had leased this ship for the use of the Royal Navy for a penny. And the idea was that when the Navy finished with it, they could buy it back for a penny. It was fantastic. We didn't sleep on it, but all these cabins were filled out with pink curtains and frills. There was gold trappings everywhere, all the mahogany. It was a beautiful thing. It was a real gin palace. But they'd had it fitted up with submarine detection equipment on board for training purposes.
Initially, did you go out straight away on the trawlers, or did you have some lectures to start with, though?
We had a few lectures, only about the first 2 or 3 days.
And what were they about?
That was mainly about maintaining the equipment, transmission procedures, reporting procedures, how the oscillator worked, how the dome was lowered from the ship, and it was very, very intense. I mean, you didn't have a half an hour to spare to yourself. We never, ever went ashore for a pub or anything like that. Once you'd had your evening meal, you were back in the lecture room. It was that intense.
So, can you go through those things that you mentioned, what you would learn there? What would you learn with, say, reporting procedures?
Well, obviously, you'd have to know how to distinguish sounds underwater, how the transmission went out, that's how I got my nickname, Ping. You've probably seen it on a lot of these war films where you get this ping going out, ping. And then if you get an echo, which is the transmission hitting an object underwater and be bounding back on you because you're listening for it, it will come back as a whoop. And it's a whoop, so you go ping, whoop. Now, you have to work out the time it took for that ping to go out, for that echo to come back, that gives you the range of the object. Now you then had to transfer left and right, so you got the range of where the ping was. Now, if it went on for some particular time, then it could be that you were hitting either land or you were hitting a minefield. If it only covered about 10 degrees, that could have been a submarine. The other time is if it comes back as a muffled sort of sound, it could be a shoal of fish. A shoal of mackerel will give you an echo. So that's when you try to use your sonar then to see if you get any noises from underneath. Now the sonar can pick up whether it's a reciprocating engine, whether it's a diesel engine, whether it's a submarine running on electric motors beneath the surface. So all these noises you have to try to interpret. And so in the classroom, they would give you all these noises, all these sounds, and then you'd listen through your earphones and you'd have to mark down what you think it is. And they could probably throw in one or two awkward ones just to try to trip you up. So that's what you did in the classrooms. It was very intensive. And how to report an echo to the bridge. Asgit Cabinet Bridge, echo sounding, so and so. Then you switch on the bridge recorder. They have a recorder up on the bridge, which is operated by you down below, and they could listen up top on the bridge exactly what you're hearing. So all these things were done in the classroom, probably in early morning, or in the evening, and in the morning you get it on a trawler, and there you'd have to do it in practice.
When you're in the classroom, you were hearing these various noises. Mm-hmm. Were they recorded?
Oh yes, they're recorded noises or sounds that they'd taken from a practice session, probably at sea. They've probably got one of their own submarines out there and that sort of thing, or they sail up to close up range scupper flow to where a minefield had been laid, and they would get those sounds on a repeater, and so they could then record that into the classroom, because otherwise, if they hadn't got that, we wouldn't know what a minefield sounded like, or a shoal of fish, or the Doppler effect from an old merchant tanker sailing through a convoy. You see, all these sounds of different ships we had to learn, because if you're sailing, escorting a convoy, and you picked up an echo, the immediate thing to do then is to contact the bridge and say, there's an echo bearing on such and such a bearing. Can you identify that object? And they say, there's nothing there. Then you knew there was something underneath the sea. So all these quick reactions had to be assessed in the classroom before you go out onto the trawlers.
You mentioned you did lectures on the oscillator.
Yeah, well, the oscillator... now, ASDIC is operated like this. Out of the bottom of the keel of the boat, there is an opening where we send it what we call the dome. Now, this can only be lowered with permission of the officer of the watch, depending on the speed of the ship. Now, the ship's going flat out at speed. You daren't lower that dome, it would rip it off. But if you're just doing cruising speed, you'd ask permission to lower the dome, or they would order you to lower the dome. And you lower this with hydraulics out of the bottom of the ship. Now, inside this dome, now the dome will probably be 10, 12 foot long. Inside this dome, which is shaped like a boat, is what they call the oscillator. Now, this is a piece of equipment which sends out transmissions, and it's inside the dome. And as we move our equipment 10 degrees at a time up top, it moves the oscillator 10 degrees or 20 degrees, whichever way you want it to go. And that is it's a quartz inside which sends out this electrical current, and that is the ping that goes out. And then when that echo comes back, it's picked up by the oscillator and recorded in your earphone.
And what equipment have you got up top?
Up top, we're in a small cabinet, and it's not right up top, it's just above the dome. It's very, very low down on the ship, and quite funny because a lot of chaps said in the mess deck, said, I wouldn't like your job. Claustrophobic, being stuck down there. Gore, he said, if a torpedo comes, you haven't got much chance. And I used to say, look, lads, if a torpedo's coming or we're just heading for a minefield, I will be the first to know. So if I come up past you through the mess deck at the rate of knots, don't ask questions, just follow me. That was always a standing joke. But our cabinet was just above the oscillator, just above the dome. Small cabinet, about 8 foot by 10. Behind you is all the transmission equipment, electrical equipment. In front of you is a small, looks like a radar screen, where you can follow the transmission on this graft. And you have a small wheel which you operate, and as you turn this wheel, it operates the oscillator. So you can move it either way, and you can follow it round. Now, you've got two of those, one either side, because normally at action stations, there's always two operators. Normal watch, two operators. But because we were short of staff, we only had six operators. There was only one on normal watch. In front of you is the voice pipe, direct to the bridge. And you have your sets of earphones, so you can not only watch the graft, but you can listen for the sound as well. It was double thing. You see, you had a visual effect like you do on radar now, and you can see the transmission going out, and you can pick up whether an echo is coming back. And from those echoes, you can tell the direction, you can tell the range, and sometimes you can even tell the speed of an object moving from left to right.
So when you'd done your initial assessment when you were at Collingwood, mm-hmm. was that the importance of the lights and the sound at the same time?
That's right, lights and sound, because this is what I couldn't understand originally. If I was going to sit down there with a pair of earphones on, why did I need to know about lights flashing on and off? But then it all came back, you see, because you're following a light pattern on your screen at the same time as you're listening to the sound, and the idea is to identify the two together.
So, you did the lectures and you used to go out onto the trawlers. Mm. What kind of drill would you do with the trawlers? You'd get up in the morning and...
Yeah, we go down to the jetty, onto the trawlers, then straight away. And that was another strange thing too. I mean, when you come to think of it, hey, all the different people went their different ways. I went down onto this trawler the first time, and there was a chap there loading oil through a hose onto the trawler. He was one of the ship's engineers. And he looked up at me and he said, God, blimey, where did you come from? He was only a school friend of mine. He went to school with me in Fleet, and in fact he lived in just down the road here, Red Squires. And that was the first time I'd seen him since we left school. And it was the last time I saw him until we came out of the Navy many years later. And there it is, just like that. But yeah,